From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Eliminating the vote. With crucial national elections around the corner, large groups of people are being strategically disenfranchised. More than 1 million African-American men and nearly 2 million immigrants will not be able to vote. A look at that and more on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is off today. First, Jeremy Scahill with the news.
The East Timor Action Network and other opponents of Indonesia's control over East Timor said today that documents leaked from the Indonesian Ministry of Defense show that the army is not withdrawing its forces in Timor, as the government has reported. Indonesia's foreign minister, Ali Alatas, has said several times in recent weeks that Indonesia stood by its pledge to keep combat forces out of East Timor. But the documents show a total of more than 12,000 Indonesian troops assigned to East Timor, twice the number of soldiers that Indonesia says are based there. They also show that the Indonesian army, known by its Indonesian acronym ABRI, counts among its numbers the members of pro-Jakarta local youth groups, militias, and public officials with ties to the army. In the past, the Indonesian government has always described these groups as spontaneous organizations. The military documents put the number of people in these groups at 9,000, bringing the total military presence to more than 21,000. And this news from Santiago, Chile. About 500 students marched through the streets of Chile's capital yesterday to protest the British High Court's ruling in favor of former dictator Augusto Pinochet. The students bore banners reading, "Long live my general in jail," and "Neither forgetfulness nor forgiveness, firing squad for Pinochet." The government and right wing have seemingly, quote, transformed Chilean impunity into a new export product, students said in a statement earlier in the day. Police eventually used tear gas on the students. Meanwhile, in Spain, an appeals court cleared the way today for the Spanish judge who ordered the arrest of Pinochet to press ahead with his bid to prosecute the ex-dictator, this according to state radio. But Judge Baltazar Garzon still faces a formidable roadblock to his effort to extradite the 82-year-old general. A decision by the London court on Wednesday declared his arrest warrant invalid. This news from Denver. According to court documents from the Oklahoma City bombing trial unsealed yesterday, if former FBI explosives expert Frederick Whitehurst had been allowed to testify at the trial, he would have disputed government witnesses on the cause of the blast. A judge unsealed the documents so defense attorneys for Terry Nichols can use it to appeal his life sentence for conspiracy. According to the document, Whitehurst would have rebutted the conclusion that the explosion was caused by an ammonium nitrate-based bomb. Before the trial had begun, Whitehurst blew the whistle on FBI misconduct. Specifically, he revealed that the explosives lab of the FBI was not an accredited institution. Whitehurst's lawyers say the chief prosecutor in the Oklahoma trial and a top FBI official threatened Whitehurst after he cooperated with the defense team. And this news from Cuba. The Cuban government said yesterday that there is enough evidence to try a Salvadoran man who confessed to a hotel bombing spree last year and four others accused of plotting terrorist acts. The Cuban daily newspaper Granma said the five suspects, belonging to a Central American-based network directed and funded by the Cuban American National Foundation, which is based in Miami. The Granma article, summarized by the Cuban government's Prensa Latina news service, said there was enough evidence to try the five for terrorism immediately under Cuban law. No trial date was set. Granma said the suspects told Cuban officials that their activities were financed by the Cuban American National Foundation and organized by Luis Posada Carriles, a Cuban exile accused by Cuban authorities of responsibility for the 1976 bombing of a Cubana airliner that killed 73 people. Several significant members of the foundation were arrested in the U.S. this summer on charges of conspiring to assassinate Fidel Castro. And this news from Texas. Two Texas separatists were cleared yesterday of plotting to kill President Clinton and other top federal officials with lethal cactus thorns, but they were found guilty of sending email threats to federal officials. And the New York Times is reporting that federal prosecutors have filed secret charges against a former sergeant in the United States Special Forces suspected of aiding Saudi exile Osama bin Laden. The Times reported that the charges are part of efforts by U.S. authorities to prove that bin Laden was behind the bombings of two U.S. embassies in Africa in August. This news from Brazil. Brazil's Roman Catholic Church yesterday criticized the fiscal austerity measures announced by the government, saying they will increase the misery of the poor. Unveiled Wednesday, the measures are a mix of hefty tax hikes and spending cuts supposedly aimed at saving nearly $24 billion next year and reducing a huge budget deficit. They are seen as essential to qualify Brazil for a rescue package of about $30 billion from the International Monetary Fund. At a press conference, the president of the National Conference of Brazilian Bishops said the measures will, quote, sacrifice the poor to satisfy the international financial community and speculative capital. In a statement, the church urged the government to introduce policies to combat growing unemployment, misery, and inequality. And finally, this news from Japan. Two U.S. servicemen were suspected of involvement in a hit-and-run car accident in Okinawa today that left a local man slightly injured, the second such incident in less than a month.
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away again today. As Tuesday's elections get nearer, there are millions of adults in this country who will not be eligible to vote. Among them are 2 million immigrants. When the Republican Revolution started cutting off social benefits and legal rights to immigrants in the mid-1990s, millions rushed to apply for citizenship, and many of those, angry at the Republican legislation, registered as Democrats. In the summer of 1996, the Clinton administration tried to streamline the process for their naturalization. It attempted to reduce the backlog of those waiting for citizenship. Those new voters tipped elections all over the country. Soon, the Republican-led Congress launched investigations of the INS, held up funds to process applications, and increased application fees. Many applicants now wait as long as 5 years. A significant portion of those immigrants are Latinos, although those waiting for citizenship come from many countries around the world. Joining us to talk about the Latino vote and voter eligibility today is Rosalind Gold. She's a senior director of naturalization programs at NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected Officials, and she joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rosalind.
Good morning, Mr. Gonzalez.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the backlog in citizenship was like several years ago, how it's changed, and why it's increased so sharply in the last couple of years?
Well, several years ago, the backlog was fairly minimal. You maybe had a few hundred thousand applicants waiting for citizenship, and generally their waits would range from 6 months to a year. As you mentioned, with this surge of applicants applying for citizenship in the early and mid-1990s, the backlog has exploded. It is at around 2 million now, folks who are just basically waiting in limbo trying to become U.S. citizens. There's several factors that have affected the backlog. First of all, there is this unprecedented number of folks who have applied for U.S. citizenship. In the early 90s, you maybe had about 300,000 to 500,000 a year applying. In recent years, that has tripled, and in 1996, there were about 1.6 million immigrants who applied for citizenship. When you couple that increased volume with a variety of bureaucratic layers of processing that have been added as a result of congressional scrutiny and the INS's action, you end up with a logjam, which is what you have right now. Folks who have filed their paperwork, gotten their fingerprints taken, completed all of the examination requirements, but who still can't become U.S. citizens.
Well, we heard quite a bit after the 1996 elections about the INS permitting people who had been convicted of felonies from slipping through the process and getting citizenship. I know that there were several investigations in Congress. What ended up being the result of those investigations? How severe was this problem that some Republicans railed about?
Well, actually, the problem was very greatly exaggerated. After they completed an investigation of a million folks who filed applications in 1994 and 1995, they found only a few, maybe about 200 or 300, who had been improperly naturalized. Now, of course, that's 200 or 300 more than you would like to see. Certainly, the system should be working fairly. It should have integrity. People who are not eligible to become citizens should not become citizens. But the extent of the problem was greatly exaggerated, and the layers of bureaucracy that have now been added to the process are really preventing law-abiding, tax-paying immigrants who are fully qualified from getting through in a timely manner.
Well, I interviewed a few days ago a woman, a Colombian immigrant who's been in this country for 7 years and is married to an American citizen. She applied for her citizenship in June of 1995, and now 3.5 years later is still waiting. But she tells me that she has had to provide fingerprints to the INS 4 different times during that period. Why this issue of people having to supply repeated copies of fingerprints to the INS?
Well, again, this is just one example of the extra bureaucratic layers that have been put into the process. When the congressional investigations were sparked, one of the problems that was noticed was that there were some people who had gone through the process without their criminal records, the records from their fingerprint checks, having come back to and being scrutinized by the Immigration Service. The Immigration Service has put in several checks into the system to make sure that that doesn't happen. But because the fingerprints that applicants submit are only good for 15 months, if the INS doesn't act on their application in that time period, those fingerprints expire and the applicants have to be re-fingerprinted. So when you have people waiting 3 years, 4 years, they may have to resubmit fingerprints when those fingerprints expire. Additionally, sometimes the fingerprints that people submit aren't always readable by the FBI. And the INS is trying to deal with this by implementing some new technology, but there's still a lot of glitches in the system.
Now, in terms of the numbers of people involved, you say 2 million nationwide, but obviously those are concentrated in key cities and in states. I understand that in New York City, there are 300,000 people who are waiting for their citizenship papers. What's it look like in some of the other major cities?
Well, in Southern California and Los Angeles, where you really have a large bulk of the applicants who are waiting to become citizens, that's where you have your largest chunk. There's about 422,000 applicants in Southern California who are in the backlog. In Texas, which is another state with a large immigrant population, you have about 212,000. So those are the areas, also in Chicago and Miami, those are the areas where you have these large concentrations. But this affects immigrants all over the nation.
Well, certainly in some of these major cities, though, the numbers are sufficient to tip practically any election if these folks were actually registered. So it does seem that that there's a method to the madness of the Republicans in holding up this process. What about the question of the impact on elections in, for instance, in the Los Angeles or Southern California area?
Well, you know, it's not entirely clear that if all of these immigrants became naturalized, that you can assume that they will vote for a particular party or for a particular candidate. These immigrants include everything from Mexican Americans in Southern California who may align themselves with the Democratic Party to Cuban Americans in Florida who may be Republicans. So the idea that somehow if all these immigrants become citizens, they'll definitely be voting for one party or the other may not necessarily be the case. What is clear is that what we saw in November 1996 is that the naturalized citizens were very active participants in the elections of November 1996. Their voting rates among Latinos in particular were higher than the voting rates of the Latino native born. Now, this is a trend we're going to be watching for November 1998 to see if this high level of participation still continues and if this momentum continues. But one of the key roles that naturalized citizens may be able to play in our democracy is to reinvigorate it and revitalize it by becoming active participants.
And why couldn't Congress just allocate more money, or would it have to allocate more money to hire sufficient staff to cut back this backlog? After all, the country is hiring, the federal government is hiring large numbers of Border Patrol agents to keep illegal or undocumented immigrants out of the country.
Well, in the budget bill that has just been passed at the end of the session, we did get some good news. There was a $171 million appropriation of funding in the INS, which should be able to address some of the problems of the backlog. But this was a fight that was a long time in coming and really took a lot of effort on the part of elected officials and advocacy groups to make sure that that funding was available. We're now going to be keeping an eye out to try to ensure that those monies are used as effectively as possible to address the problems of the backlog.
And what about the how things look in general in terms of Latino participation in this upcoming election? I understand that in 1996 there were a record number of Latinos who went to the polls, and in places like Los Angeles and New York in last year's mayoral elections, for the first time in both those cities, I think Latino voters outnumbered African-American voters in the total vote in those municipal elections. What do you see happening around the country this time around? Has there been as big a registration drive as there have been in past years?
Yes, there have been mobilization efforts all through the country to bring Latino voters to the polls. And as you had mentioned, in some recent elections, there have been record numbers of Latinos turning out. And from what we can tell, we see this high turnout occurring where there are issues that really mobilize Latino voters. In 1996, for example, when we talked about the naturalized citizens, the public debate about immigration was a debate that these naturalized citizens really wanted to get into, really wanted to make their voices heard. In Los Angeles, you had a ballot initiative affecting education, affecting rebuilding schools, which is very important to the Latino community. What we're wondering about in 1998 is, will Latino voters see the issues, see the elections, see the candidates as important to them as they did in 96, and will we continue to see that record turnout? So that's a real question for us this year.
What about the Washington State referendum that is on affirmative action? Is there significant Latino participation in that, or is there a substantial Latino population in Washington?
Well, actually, there is a growing Latino population in Washington, and it will not only be interesting to see the impact of that population on the referendum, but also on candidates who are running for state legislative office in Washington this year. There's a couple of state legislators people who are running for state legislator who are Latino, and we may see an increase of a few state legislators in Washington who are Hispanic.
There's been a lot of attention, changing the topic a little bit, to, of course, the scandals in Washington and the Lewinsky scandal and President Clinton, and most of the press has focused on the reaction of white Americans and also the African American community, which has been solidly behind President Clinton. Has Naleo done any polling, or do you have any sense of where in the Latino community, understanding that depending on the region, the nature of the Latino population changes substantially, but in terms of how Latinos regard the Clinton scandal and the move to investigate and possibly impeach the president?
Well, we haven't done any polling, but the sense that we're getting anecdotally is that the scandals may play some small role to the extent that it may make voters, Latino voters, a little bit more cynical about the political system, a little bit more cynical about government. But there are so many other exciting things and important things going on in this November election that we think that the scandals really aren't going to play a key role in Latino voting. You have things going on like an unprecedented number of Latinos running for statewide office in various states, in California, in Texas, in New Mexico. You have Latinos breaking ground at the state legislative level in states where people don't even typically think that you have large Latino populations. Michigan and Wisconsin
Rosalyn, if I can interrupt you for 1 second, why don't you hold that, and then we're going to take a small break here. We'll come back to discuss some of those races. We're talking with Rosalyn Gold, the Senior Director of Naturalization Programs at NALEO, the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is away today. We're talking with Rosalyn Gold, the Senior Director of Naturalization Programs at the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, and we're talking about the Latino vote in the upcoming elections. And we're also joined now on the phone from Washington by Carmen Jorge, who is a civil rights policy analyst for the National Council of La Raza, the largest Latino civil rights organization in the country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carmen.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask Carmen, and then we'll go back to Rosalyn, how substantially has the Latino vote grown in the last few years, and how big a portion of the total American vote is it now?
I think it's a substantial portion, and it has grown dramatically from, if you look back from 1992 to now, especially not only in terms of the numbers that are registered to vote, but also in terms of the actual voter turnout, the percentage of voter turnout within the Latino community and overall within the American community overall. So in 1992, you had anywhere from just over 3% of the Latino vote being represented in the overall total population, whereas now you're past 5% in the last 96 elections, and we expect that number to continue to rise.
And in terms of the how that vote has broken out in the last few elections, I know that in the early 80s there were substantial numbers, as many in some places as 40% of Latinos who voted for President Reagan or President Bush. But how has that developed in the last few elections?
Well, it's developed substantially, especially in California, Texas, and Florida, New York, and Illinois, those key states where Latinos play a substantial number of the overall population as well as the voting population. Their numbers have definitely carried some very key elections. For example, in Florida, obviously the Cuban vote was able to guarantee the Clinton electoral votes for Clinton in that state, and the same in Arizona, where a Democrat hadn't carried those votes in years. So I think the Latino vote has played a substantial role in key election turnout.
Well, one thing that we heard quite a bit about last year with California's Proposition 209 was that there were many Latinos who were in favor of that. But what has the polling shown after that referendum?
Well, actually, the polling shows that Latinos are still overwhelmingly in support of affirmative action programs. And if you notice, the pattern is the same for Latinos as other communities, that once they're educated in regards to what affirmative action programs are really all about and the fact that they provide opportunities, et cetera, they increase opportunities for individuals, then their support increases, and that's the same for African Americans and the overall white community. And you saw that increase in California grow during those key few months before the election, where the Latino support for it went anywhere from 50% to dramatic 70% support for affirmative action and against Proposition 209. And even more so now, you see more increased support of Latinos for affirmative action and against Prop 209, given what happened in the UC regions and the decrease in Latinos in the undergraduate programs as well as the graduate law school and medical schools. They've noticed that the impact without affirmative action would be dramatic, and obviously it's a detriment to the community.
Well, Roslyn, I'd like to get back to you. You were talking about some of the key areas around the country that people would not expect that there would be major races of Latino candidates. Could you talk about some of those particular states?
Well, first of all, as I had mentioned, we are almost definitely going to be seeing Latino state legislators, the first Latinos elected to the state legislators in Michigan and Wisconsin. In Kansas, there is a Latino running for governor, Tom Sawyer, and a Latino running for U.S. Senator, Paul Feliciano. And these are, again, not places that you'd normally identify or think of as having large Latino populations. But I think this really reflects the fact that there is Latino population growth and Latino political empowerment going on throughout the country and not just in the states that we think of as having these large Latino populations.
And I'd like to ask Carmen, what about this increasing proliferation of the Latino community throughout the United States? I mean, of course, there have been quite a few reports recently about labor struggles in places like Arkansas and North Carolina, of Guatemalans in North Carolina. What impact has this having in terms of the perception of Americans that Latinos are just basically in certain regions of the country, and what impact is that having on political processes in some of these states that we're not accustomed to having large numbers of Latinos?
Well, I think the growth and expansion of the Latino population into other states, which were not, like you said, traditionally known as large Hispanic populations in those states, is very positive, and it's good because it helps break those stereotypes. And also, we need to note that there was a substantial number of Latinos in some of those states long before we even began to really notice this increasing trend. But the negative aspect of that is that, you're right, like you said, we've been having a lot of labor strifes and a lot of problems with abuse of Hispanics moving into those new areas, and there's a lot of discrimination issues that have arisen out of that. But also, even more problematic is the fact that a lot of those small towns or those states don't have the infrastructure or the understanding of how to deal with our community or the needs of that specific community, and have come to crash to some degree. And we've had some serious concerns with civil rights violations in those states, both from employment discrimination, police abuse, abuse of INS agents in those areas, pay issues, you name it, across the board in terms of inadequate services being provided to that sector of the community. So there's some serious problems, but it's a positive move, and I think if we can all work together and educate each other as to what that means, then we can pave a way for a more positive transition for our community in those states.
And Roslyn, I'd like to ask you about one congressional race that will be watched very carefully. That's the rerun between Loretta Sanchez and B1 Bob Dornan in Southern California. How is that looking right now, and what degree of attention is being focused on it there in California?
Well, you're absolutely right. This race is being watched very, very closely, and it is a very exciting race. There is a lot at stake for the Latino community because this is a race where there were allegations raised about improper voting, but eventually Bob Dornan's challenge was dismissed by the House of Representatives. So Loretta, as usual, is doing a very, very hardworking job of campaigning, reaching out to all the voters in her district, both Latino and non-Latino. And we're hoping that she can show that, indeed, she can represent the entire district and is the choice of the people in the district.
All right. And I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. We've been talking about the Latino vote throughout the country, as well as the problems that immigrants have had in terms of the 2 million immigrants now that are still waiting for their citizenship so that they could be able to vote. We've been talking with Rosalind Gold, the Senior Director of Naturalization Programs at the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, NALEO. We've also been talking with Carmen Jorge, a civil rights policy analyst for the National Council of La Raza. Could both of you tell us if people want to be able to reach your organizations and get more information on the Latino vote or on the work of your organizations, could you give us a phone number and or webpage?
Sure. For the National Council of La Raza, the phone number is area code 202-785-1670. And you can just contact me, and I can provide that information. And
that's 202-785-1670?
Correct. And the webpage is www.nclr.org.
Yes, and at NALEO, we're on Election Day both going to be monitoring the results of the election, but we're also going to be running a program called Election Watch, where if Latino voters are intimidated or harassed at the polls, they can call us at area code 800-346-2536, and we can help deal with incidents of intimidation of harassment or harassment. But you can also contact me at that 800 number for further information, and our website is www.naleo.org.
Thank you very much, and we'll be back in a moment.
Look at them hands, look! Look at them strong cotton-picking hands.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is off today. With elections just around the corner, there are a number of people in this country, in addition to immigrants, who are not eligible to vote. Among them are a stunning proportion of black men who have been convicted of a felony. In 7 states, 1 in 4 black men is permanently disenfranchised. In 2 states, Alabama and Florida, the ratio is 1 in 3. Nationwide, a total of 1.4 million black men, 13% of the total black male population, cannot vote. If current trends continue, in a dozen states, as many as 30 to 40% of the next generation of black men will permanently lose the right to vote. In all, more than 3.9 million Americans are permanently barred from voting. All of this is fleshed out in a recent report compiled jointly by Human Rights Watch and the Sentencing Project. And joining us today to discuss the project is Mark Maurer, the Assistant Director of the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C., and Jamie Fellner, who is an Associate Counsel with Human Rights Watch. And I want to welcome both of you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Mark, I'd like you to start and tell us, give us a little bit of the history of how this has developed and in what particular states is the problem the greatest.
Well, many of these laws date back hundreds of years in their early conception, and in this country were passed just after the colonial period and sometimes updated in the post-Reconstruction period in the South. We find even some occasions where some of the southern state legislatures in the late 1800s actually tailoring their disenfranchisement laws for what they describe as to cover crimes that, quote, Negroes are more likely to commit, as they said at the time, and offenses they thought that African Americans might commit, and not including those that whites might commit. Many cases, these laws have not been examined in well over 100 years, and whether or not they served any democratic purpose in the past, which I think they didn't, clearly today, when we've done away with so many of the other restrictions on voting rights, this is really the last remaining obstacle to full inclusion of all people in our society.
And in, I know that, for instance, as I understand it, in New York State, that those who have been convicted of a felony cannot vote for the duration of their sentence usually. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. In New York, anyone currently in prison or on parole cannot vote, but they regain the right to vote once they've completed their sentence. But in 14 states, if you're ever convicted of a felony, you may lose your right to vote essentially for life. So, for example, in Virginia or Florida, you might have an 18-year-old who's convicted of a one-time drug sale to an undercover police officer. He's placed on probation for 2 years, completes it successfully, never has another brush with the law, and yet he's essentially disenfranchised for life as a result of that felony conviction.
And Jamie Fellner, in terms of the involvement of Human Rights Watch in this issue, what do you see as some of the critical concerns that other Americans should be worried about?
Well, I think they're the concerns that arise from what Mark was just saying. Voting is a right in this country and around the world. It is not a privilege. And these laws, which have origins way back when voting or political power was something restricted to very few people, primarily wealthy white men, is utterly inconsistent with notions of universal suffrage, and it cuts at the very fabric of our democracy. We have a problem getting people to vote as it is, but to deliberately and for no good purpose to exclude such a major section of an important group in this country is truly scandalous. And one of the things both Mark and I have found so remarkable is how this has managed to exist for so long with so little attention.
And how does this compare, this policy in the United States, to other countries?
Well, there's no other country in the world that we are aware of that excludes from the vote ex-offenders. That is simply for life. That is unheard of. There are a couple of countries in which for a couple of years you may be excluded if you've been convicted of electoral fraud or something directly that where there's a close link between the nature of your crime and losing the vote. With regard to prisoners voting, there are quite a few countries in Western Europe, particularly, and in Africa, where inmates can vote. There's nothing inconsistent with voting if you are an inmate.
And in most of these states, the prohibition extends only to felonies, or are there any states that it actually goes into even convictions for misdemeanors?
Primarily, it's felonies. There was some litigation, in fact, involving misdemeanors. If I remember correctly, I think it was Mississippi. But our sense is it's felonies because it's upon being sentenced to prison where it kicks in, or in some states probation. But again, the probation is if it was a felony sentence or a suspended prison sentence.
And of course,
Of course, today in the United States, felonies is a category which encompasses all sorts of conduct which previously were considered minor offenses or even misdemeanors, and especially many minor drug activities can be treated as and are treated as felonies.
Well, yes, I was specifically going to head to that area, the whole issue of the crackdown on drugs in the country, which has had an enormous impact on communities around the country. But for instance, in New York State, the Rockefeller drug laws, which are 25 years old now, require a life sentence for even small amounts of drugs. So that, for instance, if you get a sentence of 2 to life or 3 to life, even though you may come out of jail after a few years, in essence, you are permanently barred from voting because you have a life sentence. Isn't that so?
It's absolutely so. The drug laws in New York, as you and I have discussed before, are among the most punitive in the nation, and they are, in many cases, drug sentences, and perhaps in most cases, are utterly disproportionate to the offense. And one of the unintended or unexamined consequences is exactly that if you have a long parole period, you also lose the right to vote for that period.
Now, in terms of movements within the black community or within the progressive community to try to get some of these laws repealed, has there been any success anywhere in the country?
Well, I can say there's actually this week, coincidentally, in New Hampshire, there was a case brought, not on behalf of the black community necessarily, but on behalf of inmates in the prison system, whereby the New Hampshire state constitution only prohibits the vote to those convicted of treason or electoral crimes. But then the legislature has a system-wide ban on felons voting while they're in prison, and a challenge was brought to it saying that this violates the state constitution, and the court upheld the challenge and essentially has now allowed the one inmate who brought the suit to vote in next week's election. So it's a fairly significant victory there. There have been some legislative attempts in Virginia and in Alabama in the last several years, led primarily by members of the Black Caucus in those states, to try to overturn the restriction on ex-felon voting rights that essentially disenfranchise people for life. These have not been successful yet, although they've been gathering some momentum. We also have seen at the national level, Congressman John Conyers has introduced legislation that would require that ex-felons be permitted to vote in federal elections. Right now, voting in federal elections is governed by state law, so we have this sort of ironic situation whereby if you're an ex-felon in West Virginia, you can vote for president, but if you're an ex-felon in Virginia, you can't vote for president. And so this legislation would remedy that situation, at least at the federal level.
Okay. What I'd like to do, just we have to break for 60 seconds, and we'll come back. We're talking with Mark Maurer, the Assistant Director of the Sentencing Project, and Jamie Fellner, Associate Counsel with Human Rights Watch. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
I hear a bird, a glaucoma bird. It well may be he's bringing me a cheering word. I hear a breeze, a River Shannon breeze. It well may be it's followed me across the seas. Then tell me, please, how are things in Glaucomora? Is that little brook still leaping there? Does it still run down to Donnycote, through Killybegs, Kilcarry, and Kildare? He's cracking up. How are things in Glaucomora? Is that willow tree still weeping there?
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Our guests, Mark Maurer, the Assistant Director of the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C., and Jamie Fellner, Associate Counsel with Human Rights Watch. And we're talking about the 1.4 million African-American men who, because they are either in jail or been convicted of felonies, are not able to vote, 13% of all black men in the country. Jamie, I interrupted you just as you were trying to add something to Mark's last comments.
Wanted to add that in Texas, where ex-felons were prohibited from voting for 2 years following the release of their sentence, in the last legislative session, the Texas legislature changed that. So now in Texas, all ex-felons have the vote automatically. And I also wanted to add that we've been contacted by lawyers in Mississippi and in Florida who plan to file Voting Rights Act challenges to the disenfranchisement laws in both of those states.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Has this issue gone to the Supreme Court in terms of the disproportionate impact that it's having on the African-American and surely to some degree in the Latino community also? And what are the chances that that the Supreme Court might possibly overturn these state laws?
The Supreme Court has interpreted the U.S. Constitution and a provision in the Due Process Clause as permitting felony disenfranchisement. It has said where those laws were explicitly passed with the intent, or where the intent of those laws was to be to discriminate against blacks, or could be other ethnic minorities, then if they also have a discriminatory impact, they would be unconstitutional. That would give reason to believe that in certain southern states, at least, where the historical record reveals both the intent of discrimination and the current effect is of discrimination, that a legal challenge might prevail. In many states, however, that historical intent, I think, cannot be found. There's also, under a Voting Rights Act challenge, you do not need to prove, or at least that is what many lawyers assert, that the legislation was enacted to not require proof of discriminatory intent. You simply look at the effect and the circumstances and the justification. So there may be a better chance of prevailing with Voting Rights Act litigation. However, the only case that has gone pretty far with that was in New York, in fact, and it ended up at the Second Circuit with a split opinion on bank, a fairly complicated legal situation in which the court could not resolve the question of whether Congress has the power to, in essence, go beyond the Constitution on this question.
All right, well, we're going to have to end there. I want to thank both of you for being with us, Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project, and Jamie Fellner of the Human Rights Watch. Could you give us a phone number where people can reach you if they'd like more information about this issue?
Sure. At the Sentencing Project, we're in Washington. The number is area code 202-628-0871, and our website is www.sentencingproject.org.
And I can be reached at Human Rights Watch at 212-216-1212 or by email at F as in Frank, E-L-L-N-E-J at hrw.org. And our website and the report, Losing the Vote, is online both at the Sentencing Project's website and at the Human Rights Watch website, which is www.hrw.org.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. And we're going to switch now to Bob Henley, who is our Democracy Now! Elections correspondent. And yesterday, the Democrats edged ahead in a couple of key Senate races as their party lashed back against Republican advertising campaigns urging voters to punish President Clinton in next Tuesday's midterm election. So I'd like to bring in Bob Henley. And Bob, maybe if you could tell us a little bit about these final last-minute dueling campaign ads and what the impact has been?
Sure. I think that you're referring to particularly the California race, which had good news for Boxer, the incumbent Democrat going up against Matt Fong, and also here in New York with Congressman Schumer pulling ahead of D'Amato. What this really emphasizes is the essential nature of the African-American and Latino vote. Truly, if these folks don't turn out, and the Democratic Party loses some of these bellwether elections, what will happen is the Democrats will be closer to Whig status. In California, for instance, the potential, if you have Latino vote at 25.8% of the electorate, 7.4% African American. And similarly in New York, you have the same kind of potential clout with, I think it's something near 12.3% Latino and 15.9% African American. So clearly there needs to be some kind of coalition building that up to now has eluded the Democratic Party nationally. In the congressional situation, we see some things. There were 24 Republicans who were elected with less than 51% of the vote in 1996. Now remember, there's only an 11-seat gap between the Republicans who dominate over the Democrats in the House. And in 24 of those, I've calculated that 1, 2, 3, 4 of those races have considerable Latino and African-American representation. And we're talking about races that won that were decided by hundreds of votes.
What are some of those races?
Well, you have certainly the Sanchez race against B1 Bob Dornan, who, of course, in a very cynical attempt to try to exploit the diversity of the Latino community. I don't know if you know about this, but he sent out palm cards of the Virgin of Guadalupe saying that he is the only true Latino because he's against abortion. That's the kind of cynical ploy. You see Don Lundgren, for instance, running for governor, trailing Gray Davis, of course, primarily because of his anti-choice status, now in the final days trying to find the silver lining in that by appealing to Latino voters who send their kids to parochial school by saying that he's for vouchers. And also hitting his anti-choice position to try to resonate again, to try to get that 30% potential vote of, conservative Latinos. So, and also, I mean, J.D. Hayworth in Arizona, the 6th District, this is a flamboyant reactionary congressman from Arizona, former sports broadcaster. And this gentleman is in a district that has 13% Latino and 22% Native American. And he won with under 50% of the vote. So the question here is, can this sleeping giant wake up and have the discipline to follow through on election day?
Well, one indication that the White House at least is hoping that that happens is that on Sunday, Vice President Gore will be basically finalizing or having the last rally of all the Democratic Party candidates in New York City, in, of all places, the South Bronx. And all the major figures will be meeting and rallying there to try to energize the Latino community. And seeing the Bronx, of course, as the only area of New York City that overwhelmingly voted for against Mayor Giuliani in the last race, they're hoping to turn out large numbers of voters there and send a message across the state in their effort to defeat Al D'Amato, of course, powerhouse.
Of course, that's going to be received. If Schumer can pull this out, even if they don't pick up House seats, they need one or two trophy wins. If they can just knock off one or two Republican senators with the savvy spin machine of the White House, they'll have a good headline the next day. And that's really what it's about. It's ironic about the South Bronx because clearly, in my book, and the last Democratic politician to really do good coalition building was Robert Kennedy. And I don't know that we've seen a character emerge on the national stage who can galvanize these very diverse groups. I mean, there's, the Chicano experience, there's the Dominican experience. There certainly is no, and as you pointed out before, I guess the most divergent that African-American and Latino voters were was back with Reagan, where some 37-38% supported Reagan and some 9% African-American supported Reagan. And I think, part of this is the legacy of the politics of racial identity and division. In many urban areas, we've seen a situation where the white Democratic oligarchy is trying to hold on to power by cynically playing the races off against each other. And that may translate for short-term success for the white incumbent, but you can't build a national coalition of people of color who will be the majority in this country in the next century with that kind of attitude provincially.
What about Texas? What's going on in Texas in terms of the there's been a lot of attention focused on the fact that George Bush has made deep inroads into the large Latino community in Texas. What about other races around that state?
Well, I think that clearly the question is what you see in Texas, though, is the phenomena of unopposed races. I mean, that's another thing we haven't talked about here that's kind of a shadow over this whole thing. While the present circumstance looks hopeful for the Democrats, consider that 96 of the House races are unopposed out of 435. That's over 20%. And in the South, in places like Texas and in places like Louisiana, in South Carolina, we have out of 128 congressional seats in the South, 62 unopposed, and most of them Republican. You have 11 unopposed, for instance, in Texas. So clearly, the race to watch is going to be the attempt by the former mayor of Albuquerque, Martin Chavez, the Democrat, to turn out Gary Johnson, the incumbent Republican governor of New Mexico. And there, clearly Chavez has the potential critical mass to do it. 40% of New Mexico is Latino. I have to say that all eyes are on Bush in the sense that if he cracks 40%, believe it or not, of Latino vote, he's going to be seen as some kind of New Age healer. Whether that's right or not, clearly the problem there is that I think the Democratic Party may have taken some of these key constituencies for granted historically.
And in terms for those people who don't want to hear it about either the Democrats or the Republicans, what does it look like in terms of any independents, any independent races or independent party candidacies?
Right, it's interesting you should say that, because in the void that's created when you have 96 districts where you don't have major party opposition, there has been an emergence of the Green parties, the Libertarians, and the Natural Law candidates. The Green Party, particularly the congressional races in Mexico, there's a couple where, for instance, I think Gephardt tried to dissuade the Greens from mounting an effort. And so I think you're also, I mean, the whole thing is going to hinge on turnout. Remember that historically between 34% and 38% of the potential voters turn out in an off-year federal election. And that number has been declining. The problem in all of this, though, is that the Republicans are getting money in unprecedented levels, and the Democratic financial advantage is considerable. At this point, the Democrats have raised $165 million up against the Republicans, $260 million. And there's even more coming in now that we don't have the numbers for. Add to that the emergence of this sinister role of the independent expenditure, not included in those numbers, which the Annenberg group estimates to be $330 million in the last 18 months, directed and targeted most often at progressive candidates. And you see the tremendous disadvantage that progressive candidates are at.
Okay. Bob, and finally, a quick, just quickly, Maine, the Green Party candidate in Maine for governor. Any possibilities?
Well, I think that, again, there it depends on whether or not the environmentalists have come of age in terms of grassroots potentiality. Will they have phone banks? I mean, that's really the thing that has to happen. They have to have the kind of in-the-field operation that I'm sure we're going to see in operation in the South Bronx. And without that, you know, the thing is, if they can register above 20%, they're going to be players.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for being with us again, Bob Hennelly, the elections correspondent for Democracy Now!, and we'll be hearing much more from you next week. I'd like to...
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Those of you who are regular listeners know that Amy Goodman has not been here the past few days. We'd like to let you know that Amy's father, who suffered a stroke a few days ago and unfortunately did not survive. We all extend our deepest sympathies to Amy and her family at this most difficult time, all of us here at Democracy Now! And at Pacifica. And any cards and correspondence can be addressed to Amy Goodman, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 10005. Amy, to you and your family, our thoughts are with you.
Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over that rainbow. Why then, oh, why can't I? If any little bird can fly beyond the rainbow, why, oh, why can't I?
You've been listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to call our comment line, you can call 212-209-2999. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to reach us via email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. And you can hear us on the web at www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Michelle Garcia is our web spinner. Julie Drizin, executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Juan Gonzalez with another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Sometimes